Hi, everybody. It's Monday. It's 1 o'clock, and so it's time to for our half hour Pirkei Avot history and Hashkafa. I had the privilege last Shabbat of being at our sponsoring synagogue, Tel Aviv International Synagogue. Some of you I got to see there. Next time, you know, I'd like to see more of you. Either a Friday night or Shabbat morning or both, whatever. It was a wonderful time, and it's a wonderful, and you guys are a wonderful community. Okay, so we are finally moving on to a, again, put the book down. We are finally moving down to onto another Mishnah, still dealing with the words of Hillel the Elder. In this case, a Mishnah which is fraught. I think that's the best word for it. It's really a fraught Mishnah. Let's jump in. We're talking about Mishnah, the second chapter, Mishnah number, and number six. Af hura agulgolet. Hillel was walking along. He came to a wadi, to a stream, or to a river. And he saw a skull. Ra'a gulgolat achat shetzafa al pnei ha'mayim. He saw a skull that was floating on the face of the water. Amarla. So he told it. He addressed it. Still in the water. He didn't pull it out of the water. He left it in the water. Al da'atev tatfuch. Because you browned other people, other people drowned you. V'sof metayfayich, and those who drowned you, in the end, your fate will be theirs as well. In other words, they will be punished the exact same way. There's a lot to unpack in this Mishnah. Clearly, Hillel's point of departure is the assumption of divine justice, that there is a concept of measure for measure, midah keneged midah, famous, it's not a uniquely Jewish idea or something. It may very well have been derived from Jewish sources, certainly in terms of the Christian world. I mention it because Shakespeare himself has a famous play called Measure for Measure. But when I see this Mishnah, I don't think of that Shakespearean play. I think more of a famous scene in Hamlet, which I would like to contrast with Hillel's statement before we sort of get down to its basic which root implications. In Hamlet, Hamlet's walking along the way. I think it's the fifth act. And there is a gravedigger who is busy disinterring people. And they discovered a skull. And the gravedigger said, I knew that skull. That's Yorick, the former jester of the court of the King of Denmark, who was the father, the murdered father of Hamlet, for those of you who don't know the story. And Hamlet says to the gravedigger, let me see it. Let me see this skull. So he takes the skull, and he says as follows, alas, poor Yorick, I knew him, Horatio, a fellow of infinite jest, of most excellent fancy. He hath borne me on his back 1,000 times, and now how abhorred in my imagination it is. It's a terrible thing to remember when you when you contrast his present state of being totally decomposed and simply just a skull, with the mirth and the joy that he gave me. My gorge rises at it. In other words, he has to sort of swallow. Here hung those lips that I've kissed, I know not how oft. Where be your jibes now? Where are your jokes? Your gambols? Your various outrageous actions? Your songs? Your flashes of merriment that were wont to set the table on a roar that would got people historically laughing? Not now to mock your own grinning, a sort of evil grin from the skull. Quite chopfallen, you're sort of crestfallen from the fact that you're dead. Now get you to my lady's chamber and tell her, let her paint an inch thick to this favor, she must come. Make her laugh at that, prithee, Horatio. Tell me one thing. He's talking to Ophelia that Ophelia should go and get ready for its coming. What's striking is the upshot of this encounter of Horatio with of Yorick, Hamlet with Yorick's skull is effectively the idea that life is worthless. All comes to dust. What good is you? I mean, his validity was in making fun of things, in general. In other words, so in a funny way, Yorick, in the dust-like and meaninglessness of his present existence, puts the lie to anything constructive in his own life. And there is Hamlet's a tragedy. It's a very depressing and pessimistic view of life. This is it. This is all that waits for us, is the grave, and that's all. Strikingly, when you look at the way, now, that's the way he looks at death. That's the way he looks at Yorick. That's the way he looks at whatever. The best you can do in life is to be funny and to make fun of life, and then at the end of the day, you're just a decomposed corpse. Strikingly, if you look at Hillel's statement, he also encounters a skull. And according to many commentators, he recognized the person whose skull it was, because there's a moral issue, which we will get to in a minute. Knowing whose skull it is, what's his reaction? His reaction is to see this person who obviously died an unnatural death and didn't have the privilege of being buried properly. And Hillel says that your ending is confirmation of a number of very, very deep moral rules which guide our lives. Number one, people ultimately get what they have coming to them. Let's assume for a minute he knows who this person was. You were the head of a crime family. You drowned other people. So it comes to you as well. Measure for measure. And this idea that the punishment fits the crime is a theme that runs through Jewish ethical literature, runs through the Torah. I know that it raises other moral issues, and we will get to them. But the assumption is here that as opposed to Hamlet, who sees the encounter, for whom the encounter with Yorick, Yorick's skull, to be more precise, is a moment in which he points out the meaninglessness of life, Hillel sees the skull and says, no, ultimately there is justice. Ultimately, there is, people get their just desserts, or their right desserts, and exactly in the way that God wants that punishment to be meted out. And he says, don't forget, and then he goes on, he says, it's not just that. Those who did this to you will in the end meet the same fate. In other words, once you start down the path, the emperor says, once you start the path of the dark side, you're caught up in it. Those of you who you meet who are your teachers in the dark side will end up acting out on you, and you will do to them, and then they will do to you, and there's an endless cycle of violence and injustice, which you can allow yourself, because it's freedom of will, you can allow yourself to get involved in. The message, of course, is Don't take the first step down the dark side. Interestingly, and I don't think I have to make a big deal about pointing this out, there are serious other moral issues of theodicy that arise in this Mishnah. Theodicy meaning the question of God's judgment. Because not everybody who drowns is being punished for having been drowned. And not everybody, for having drowned other people. And not everybody who commits a crime gets punished appropriately. So what was it the Hillel was trying to, what was it the Hillel was trying to say? This question bothers the commentaries from beginning to end. And they offer different possibilities. I'd like to pick out, actually, two or three as options of understanding a very, very difficult and very problematic, very troubling statement by Hillel. Okay, number one. The first one, comes from the early 15th century. There was a man whose name was Rabbi Matityahu HaYitzhari. I think I've mentioned him before here. Matityahu HaYitzhari was a prominent rabbi in Spain in the early years of the 15th century. And he was one of the leaders of Spanish Jewry who were summoned by the Pope, the anti-Pope. Anti-Pope meaning his basically, what's a Pope and an anti-Pope? It's always a Pope. What's an anti-Pope? An anti-Pope is a Pope that got elected, but his election was never confirmed or never justified. In other words, when there's a fight between popes, the guy who loses, he's the anti-Pope. So there was an anti-Pope in Spain, in the city of Tortosa, actually Barcelona also, whose name was Benedict XIII. And Benedict XIII, in order partly to strengthen his bona fides as a pope, staged an enormous disputation in the city of Tortosa. It lasted a year and a half in 1410 to 1412, remember, 1410 to 1411, in which he tried to posited the proposition that the Talmud is a Christian book, and you can derive the beliefs of Christianity from the Talmud, meaning if Jews want to be real Jews, the good Jews, they have to be Christian. What he's trying to do is to take away the oral law from the Jews to lead to general collapse by the Jews in Spain, and with the hope or the expectation the Jews would then simply become Christians. This is not the first time this had been raised. The first time this had really been raised on a large scale had been a disputation of 1263 in Barcelona, in which Nachmanides confronted the apostate Paul Christian, Paul Christiani, who was trying to make the exact same point. In this case, this is 150 years later, in this case, the Pope was a little bit shrewder than the church and the royal authorities in the 13th century. What they did was they took all of the major rabbis of Spain and put them effectively under house arrest in the city of Tortosa so that they could not have any contact and isolated them from their communities. And then Christian Catholic preachers and especially Franciscan and Dominican friars went throughout the country leading mass meetings to convince the Jews to convert to Christianity. These were accompanied by violence, not infrequently, and there was no one to stand up to them. So basically, the Pope deprived the Jews of their leadership while they basically while the church ran rampant, force converting Jews throughout Spain. This was really stage two in the destruction of Spanish Jewry. Part one was the great nationwide riot of 1391, and then you have 20 years later you have this disputation, and some 80 years later finally the Jews will be totally expelled from Castile and Aragon. One of the participants in this disputation was Matityahu HaYitzhari. I mentioned this whole story about the disputation in Tortosa because Matityahu HaYitzhari wrote a commentary on Pirkei Avot, And I find, at least, I don't think it's my imagination either, I find that the trauma of being held, of having to deal with these church officials and watching how masses of Jews are forced converted to Christianity, while he can't do anything about it, that the trauma of being part of this disputation and the tragedy that was unfolding over Spanish Jewry, it oozes out from between the lines. It just cries out from between the lines of his commentary. So when it comes to this Mishnah, I think it's very, very clear this way. Rabbi Matityahu says, the function of this Mishnah is to say that ultimately there is divine justice. Ultimately, justice is not in our hands. Now, you can understand the Mishnah to say, no, this is sort of like, you get it, if you join the mafia, so you kill them and they kill you. I mean, it never ends, right? So he's saying, no. No, 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 no. There's somebody who runs the, there's a balabas leisek, we would say, or the geshäft. The world has a moral guide, and that is God. And the reason why you were drowned is God brought about the circumstances so you would be punished for your ill deeds. And similarly, those who did that to you will also be punished. In other words, this is a statement by Matityahu Yitzhari to his audience, saying, don't think that we are powerless. Don't think that we will be unavenged. Don't think that we are at the end of our ropes. Don't think that the story of Spartak Jewry is going to end here. Don't think that Spain is going to get away with this. That because you went and drowned other people, you were drowned and others will come and drown you. And the others, those who drowned you will be drowned as well. Now, as it happened historically, he's right about Spain. When the Jews were thrown out of Spain, basically Spain signed its own death warrant. And from an economic point of view, Spain has never, ever recovered from expelling its Jews. But the larger issue is that this is an affirmation of faith, even against all odds, that there is justice in the world, and that there is a judge in the world, and there is a law in the world, despite what appearances would seem to convey. So that is what Matityahu Yitzhari says, and I'm sure that it's a cri de coeur, it's a cry from the heart, from what he experienced himself. However, as I mentioned before, there is a serious, serious, serious problem here. And I'm not going to, there's no way to mistake it. Not everybody who drowns deserves to, at least as far as we know. And drowning is, a person who drowns, it's from a religious point of view, presents a moral challenge, not just because of the death of the individual, it's the circumstances of their death. People die. I mean, death is part of life. But drowning, which is, I thank God never drowned, but I can imagine. I mean, all you have to do is hold your breath and you can begin to understand, have some kind of idea of what it means to drown. Drowning is a horrific way of dying. And according to the Torah, a person, after they die, a person's dignity has to be cared for, respected, so that their body is purified, they're put into shrouds, the body is treated with dignity because it was a place where the soul dwelled, and it's brought to Kever Yisrael, it's brought to be it properly interred. Which is a major value in Judaism. We don't leave the body overnight for unless there's extraordinary reasons, because it's an indignity to the person who died. The idea that a Jew should not have been buried properly and had that last dignity, when that happens, is a terrible tragedy. Otherwise, I mean, I'll give you an example. My dear friend, Professor Simcha Golden, whose son Hadar was killed in Soketan, in the last, in the previous, not the last one, but the previous war with Gaza, the Hamas in their evil and malevolent ways are holding the bodies of Hadar and his fellow soldier Oren Shaul hostage. They're also holding two live Israelis hostage. And Simcha and his wife Seleia have been trying to move heaven and earth to bring their son home to be buried properly, because that's part of our humanity as far as the Torah is concerned. A proper burial. It's why cremation is such an anathema. It's a proper burial. It provides closure, and also provides the mourners with some place to go. That's not a small thing. We don't worship graves, and I think it's a fundamental misunderstanding of the idea of going to, say, so-called sacred places, the graves of righteous rabbis and so on. That is not, nobody prays to the dead here, or they shouldn't, but it's a question of being as close physically to people from whom you cared as possible. It's also a big, great part of it. So it's a torture to those who survive if somebody dies and isn't buried. It's part of the horror of the Shoah, which is the automatic first thing that, of course, we think about when we encounter this Mishnah. And that is not everybody who is drowned deserved it, did anything to merit it, and certainly not, that doesn't, is nothing about the right of people not to have proper burial. Strikingly, the rabbis already anticipated this in circumstances which are, to a certain degree, anticipate the modern times. The rabbis tell the story of 300 young men and women who were taken captive. The Midrash tells a story, or it's actually a Gemara in Gittin as well. It's not clear whether it's after the destruction of the first and second temple, or whether it's in the wake of Bar Kokhba. Wake of Bar Kokhba, the amount of Jews who were taken and sold into slavery was massive, to the degree that the Roman historians say that there were so many Jews who were sold into slavery that the slave market collapsed. But these 300, according to the Midrash, were taken to be sold into sex slavery, that they were sold to be male and female prostitutes or male and female sex toys. And there could be nothing more horrific, no future more horrific, especially if you might be for the parents, than that kind of life of degradation and decadence. So the Midrash tells a story that the kids decided that this is not for us. And while they were on the boat being transferred from Eretz Israel to Rome, they decided to commit suicide. Now, strikingly, I mean, we all know that suicide per se is prohibited. We'll find out later on Pirkei Avot that the Mishnah says that if you commit suicide, then you forfeit your place in the world to come, or you endanger your soul after you die. All kinds of stuff. So suicide is not a thing, right? But they wanted it. But they were determined they were not going to live this life in which they were violating one of the on a regular basis, even against their own will. Even against their own wills. One of the three great great prohibitions for which martyrdom is required according to Jewish law, which are apostasy, killing somebody else, and sexual depravity. The Midrash keeps going and says that the children prayed and wanted a sign to see if they commit suicide, is there such a thing as resurrection of the dead? In other words, confirming their status as righteous if you drown. And a voice came out of heaven and announced that, in fact, God promises that he will bring back the dead. He will resurrect the dead even from the depths of the sea. When they heard that, they, Shema Yisrael, and jumped in the water en masse and drowned. What's the point? The point is that this is in stark contrast to Hillel. Because as opposed to Hillel, they're also talking about bodies that they're not going to be found. They're people that are drowned. But here they're people that are drowned. They're not being punished. They're doing this and they're undergoing this because they want to avoid sinning. It's the polar opposite. Now, I don't think Hillel, of course, died 60 years before the destruction of the temple. So he couldn't have known that this was coming. But the rabbis did. And I think they realized that you can't always be, Elmer Gantry dogmatic, saying, this person died for that sin. Nobody's God's accountant. People sometimes drown. Some people drown because they got themselves caught up in a dynamic of violence and evil. And others drown because for other reasons, not for their fault. And sometimes they drown because drowning at this point is the right thing. So what's the resolution? The resolution, I think, comes back to Rabbi Matityahu Yitzhari. Hillel, as many of the commentators note. Doesn't say, because you drowned somebody, then you automatically ground. Atzfuch, the statement that Hillel makes is a statement of conviction. God brings things about, so that you did X, and then X will be done to you. So at the end of the day, as Rabbi Matityahu Yitzhari wanted to point out, the same circumstances, they really look the same. Same circumstances of drowning or whatever the case might be, sometimes are a punishment. Sometimes they're a testimony to a person's integrity. And the one, capital O, who knows to make the distinction is God. Because it's an affirmation, this mission is an affirmation of the fact that there is divine justice. Beyond us, men are limited. The sin of contemporary men is arrogance. Men are limited in their understanding. God will determine which is the one who deserves it. Which is the one who should be resurrected. It's not up to man. It's not up to people to judge others because you don't know what they went through and you don't know what brought them to this circumstance. One thing is absolutely clear, however, and that is that Judaism rejects summarily the pessimism, the vacuousness, the despair that was expressed by Hamlet upon encountering the skull of Yorick. Okay, so that's enough for today. Did a whole mission in one sitting. Go no. Please share this. This will be on my Facebook page. It'll be on my Rabbi Professor Jeffrey Wolf page. Wherever I welcome you to ask questions, to expand this sort of this community of learning Mishnah Avot and the ideas that we raise, and I will see you, please God, next Monday. Be well.